Well, hello, friends. This is Mark Gladman, also known as Brother Frederick James, your friendly neighborhood monk in docks. And this is episode 7 of the Monk on the Mic podcast. And this one is called Undefine. And before I jump in, a couple of things really quickly about the table. The table is up. And this is why I've been away from doing a solo Monk on the Mic for a little while. Some things went wrong with the app project. It wasn't going to suit the purposes of what we were doing, and there were limitations on how many people could be involved, and I couldn't have those. And I'm glad I did, because 1 week into having the table open, and already the number of people who are on the website and have joined the community and so on is beyond that which the app would have been able to handle. So I'm really glad that that was discovered, and then we rectified that very quickly, although it was last minute and there was a lot of work involved. But I'm so pleased. Thank you to all those people who have gone and had a look at the website, and thank you to all those people who have joined us there. The website you'll find at monkindocs.podia, that's P-O-D-I-A, monkindocs.podia.com. You can try monkindocs.com, but apparently some people are having trouble with that. But go to the website and have a look and see what you can see. There's lots of free stuff there. One of those things is a free Lent study, and I know today we are 1 week into Lent, but it's never too late to jump in and start and be a part of that. So I will invite you to join us for a free Lenten study for each day, or each week rather, of the study. There's 7 studies, and for each study there's a written version of the study. There's a spoken audio version of the study, which isn't just me reading it. It's me talking about it, and some of it's the same, but it's fleshed out a little bit more in some places. And there's also a Lectio Divina guided meditation and contemplation audio, which uses the Bible passage for that particular week as the focus. And the focus of the study is each week for the 7 weeks, we are looking at the 7 I Am statements in John's Gospel and using those as lens through which to look at the Passion story, the Easter story. And so it's been very, very fun putting it together, and I'm learning so much about seeing Easter in new and fresh ways through these 7 I Am statements, and I hope you do too, and I hope it really helps you go deep. There's only one study a week, and that was done intentionally. I know some Lenten studies you have something every day, but I really wanted to give people the space to allow these words of Jesus to sink really, really deep and help us not just to see Easter in new and fresh ways, but to help or allow those things to change and transform us into who we are meant to be. So that's all up at the table. There's also other courses, but most importantly, 2 things I want to point out. One is the community, where you can join the community and start to share ideas, thoughts. There's like forums there, and you can share and develop and comment on each other's things, and there'll be other things that'll be going up there where we'll be starting conversations, not just around the courses, but around other things, having things like book clubs and all sorts of stuff like that. And then there's also a paid version of that. Now, that's simply there because I needed to create a way to try and make this financially viable, because if the this is obviously costing money to make this available to people. So this is a kind of a Patreon thing where you can join for a monthly subscription, and it's less than 40 cents US a day, but it allows me to help keep the table going and to put the energy and the resources and pay for the infrastructure and everything else that makes it possible for us to do this. And so that's not necessary, but it is an option. And there are some things in there that I throw in for the supporters, which I guess make it a little bit tasty for your 40 cents. But go and have a look at that. But there's a whole bunch of free stuff up there as well. You don't have to join the community, but it helps if you do. You don't have to take a subscription, but it helps what we're doing in this work of making this stuff available for people if you do, if you're able to do that. So go take a look. The table, again, the website is monkindocs.podia.com, and I look forward to seeing you and interacting with you there as the little gathering around that thing grows. And thank you again to all those people who have taken a look. Right, undefine. Let's have a talk about this. The very first verse in the very first chapter of the Tao Te Ching. You're probably thinking that's a really weird place to start. I'll talk about it in a second. So in the Tao Te Ching, Lao Tzu writes this: the Tao that can be named is not the eternal Tao. Now, Taoism is a Chinese philosophy. A lot of people say, oh, it's a religion and all this other stuff. Not really. It's more of a philosophy. It's a way of seeing and being in the world. And it's a philosophy that talks a lot about becoming more connected to nature and to the flow of things and the way that the world flows with seasons and changes and the way that, the rain cycles and all this sort of stuff are all lessons for us in learning how to live life in ways that are far more enriching and far more beneficial, and work with things rather than try and push and force against them. The word Tao has a lot of understandings, apparently. The one that's most commonly thought of is the way, and or the flow. So, to give you a comparison, though, in John's Gospel, the first chapter, John chapter 1, verse 1, John writes, "In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God." And that word that's translated as word is logos, which we've talked about on the show before. That word logos is an old philosophical word pre-John that talked about this force, this essence, this energy, this creative way, the thing that keeps the world going and alive and is the creation of all things and the genus of all things and so on. What's interesting is when they translated the Bible into Chinese, that in John's Gospel, they chose to translate logos as Tao. So when you read the Bible in Chinese, John chapter 1, verse 1 says, "In the beginning was the Tao, and the Tao was with God, and the Tao was God." Now, Chinese would say Tao has nothing to do with God, or the Taoists would say Tao has nothing to do with God. My point is, though, I want to show you that this word Tao is, and logos, are seen as similar things, this energy, this force in the universe that's been a part of having all things be, and is the energy that keeps things going, sustains all things, and all that sort of thing. And Lao Tzu says, you cannot name it. Because the moment you name it, then it's no longer truly the Tao. Because the Tao cannot be named. And so there's this idea that when you name it, instantly, not what you've named, because it doesn't change the substance of the thing. Right? If I've got my dog sitting here with me as I do the podcast recording today, and if you hear them, particularly one of them snoring, hello, Saxon, who's asleep, apologies for that advance. But I call, the one dog Saxon, one dog Stanley. We could have called, I mean, my wife named Saxon, she had him before we met, but we could, when we got Stanley, we could have named him, and we actually had a list of names, we could have called him any of those things. It would not have changed who Stanley was. Stanley was who Stanley was. And so when we're talking about when we name it, it doesn't change the substance, but it changes how we see it. And it changes how we react to it. Because the second we name something, we're placing a label on it, and in that label, there is a particular understanding around it. And actually, Stanley's a really good point in case now I think about it, because Stanley is this frolicking, rollicking, absolute rambunctious punk of a mini Dachshund. And he's a joy to watch, and we love him to bits, and he has these moments of deep contemplation and meditation watching the sun go down, and then he suddenly pops back into this, you know, full roly-poly mode. But what's interesting is I do wonder if we'd given him a different name, not that it would have changed him, but it would have changed how we saw him. If we gave him a different name, might it have changed how we see the roly-poly rambunctiousness? Stanley kind of has this, you know, fun sort of vibe to it. What if we called him something really, really serious and he acted like that? Would we think he's being a bad puppy? I don't know. But can you see how as soon as you name something, you kind of attribute some things to it? Because when you name something, in a way, what you're doing is you're defining it. And the second you decide that you're going to call God this or Tao that, what you're actually saying is that this is how I see it and understand it. And once you do that, you start to put some things in concrete, and that becomes really, really dangerous. Now, naming things isn't all bad. I think there's something good about naming things, but we've got to be careful about how we do it. In fact, one of the very first activities in the Hebrew scriptures, after the God who creates the heavens and the earth and everything that's in it, then God creates this human being, and, well, sorry, Genesis 2 story, God creates the heavens and the earth, then God creates this human, and then God creates all these animals. And one of the first activities that God gives this human being to do is to name them. And I often talk with students about why. Why do you think this God had this person name the animals? Now, the purpose that we're given in the text is because the God wanted to see if the human could find a companion to do life together with. If there was someone or something within that mix of animals that would be a great companion to have around. And of course, the end of the story, there is none. But what's interesting about thinking about this man naming these things is that in naming them, when you name something, that there's kind of this idea that you have some sort of relationship with it, some intimacy with it. It's a weird example, but think about when you buy, or some people who buy a car, and then they name it. How that changes their relationship with the car. In fact, I have a friend who has had a car for 30-something years, bought the car when it was already 20 or 30-something years old, and refuses to sell it because he's got this relationship with the car. Not weird, but he does. He's just got this connection to the car. And I think it's because he named the car. And he literally never calls the car the car. He calls it Margaret. He just cannot think of that. So that when we name something, there's this connection to it, this relationship with it. And so in that sense, naming things isn't all bad. Because if it points out that we have a responsibility towards it because we were the ones who gave it the name, then that's obviously a good thing because it highlights that responsibility and keeps it in the forefront of our minds. When the human beings name the animals, their responsibility then is to look after them and care for them and the environment in which they're in. So naming something isn't all that bad, but the human trait seems to be to define things through the name. So we tend to name things that we then believe we possess. And again, if you own something, there's technically nothing wrong with that, but some people become so attached to things because they name them that it can become incredibly unhealthy. Sometimes we name things to label them because we want it to be seen in a particular way. So you see people who name their properties. They buy a house and land. Often this is done with farms or in the States, ranches as well. And they name it something. And they name it that thing because that's what they want it to be like. They want it to represent. And in some ways we do this with or parents do this with children when they choose names for their children. Some people just choose names because they're pretty. Some people, however, get right into it and they'll look through all the definitions of a name and they'll give the child that name because that's the particular character trait that they would love for their child to have. So sometimes when we name things, we're labeling them. And then finally, I think one of the other reasons that I come up with that we like to name things is because when we name them, then we think we control them. And again, sometimes that is good because when we name it, there's a responsibility to keep it under control. But there's also an insidious sort of thing in that where if I've named it, then I get to call the shots on it. I get to tell it what to do. I get to tell you what you can do with it. So you can see how this defining things and naming them can have a little bit of a good thing about it, but often when we name things, we end up in a problem because in naming it, we suddenly find ourselves in a position where we could be unhealthily trying to possess it, unhealthily trying to label it, or unhealthily trying to control it. And so the problem is that when we name things and they're these things, that becomes a definition because it's defined. And the problem with that is when the name sticks, it's then hard to change. And suddenly, the thing that was named is now restricted and it's boxed. You've named it, you've defined it, and in your mind, this is how you see it. In John's Gospel, going back to John again, chapter 3, verse 8, Jesus is talking to a Pharisee at night and he talks to them about the Spirit. This Pharisee is inquiring about, we all know you're of God, which is interesting in itself. A Pharisee comes to him and says, we've all talked and we know you're come from God, you're a messenger from God. But then he's talking about, you know, what it means to be a follower of God. And Jesus comes in with this statement about the Spirit and says that the Spirit is like wind and it will move anywhere and everywhere it wants to. And you can't tell where it's coming from or where it's going to go. And that's what it's like. That's what the Spirit is like. And this is why the Celts talked about the Spirit as being like the wild goose. The name that the Celts gave to Spirit was Engon Glas. I hope for my Celtic friends, I hope I've said that correctly. But the name means the wild goose, because they saw the Spirit as like a wild goose, and you go chasing after the wild goose and the wild goose takes off and you've got to go looking for it and hunting it. You don't know where it's going, you don't know where it's come from, you don't know where it's going to be, where it's going to come back. And this is what the Spirit's like. It's like wind. And in fact, the word for Spirit in both Greek and Hebrew, ruach for Hebrew, pneuma for Greek, literally means wind. So there's this idea that Jesus is trying to get across to Nicodemus, the Pharisee, that's important, that he's a religious leader who obviously has some defined perspectives about who God is and how God does stuff. And Jesus comes in and says, dude, you just can't define God. You can't box God, you can't cage God, you can't put a boundary around God, you can't put a definition on God, because the second you do, you do not allow God to be who God is. The Spirit moves wherever it needs to move, wherever it wants to move. And you've got to have some permission for that. There's another passage where Jesus is speaking to the Pharisees, after he had healed a man who was blind, he'd restored his sight. And there's this whole conversation that comes up about who is blind and who can see, now that this blind man can see, but the Pharisees refuse to see that this blind man can see and that God might have done something beautiful in this person's life. And at the in the last little bit of conversation, and I'm sort of pulling a condensed version of the two different conversations, one that Jesus has with the blind person, or the formerly blind person, and one Jesus has with the Pharisees. Jesus says to the Pharisees, basically, the very fact that you claim that you can see is why you are blind. And as long as you continue to state that you can see, you will be blind. So think about that for a second. Here you've got a group of people. Somebody has received a miracle in their life. These people are refusing to acknowledge it. And the reason why they're refusing to acknowledge it is in their is that in their minds, this is not how God's supposed to work. They had named God, defined God, put boundaries around God, and now that this had happened right before their eyes, they couldn't see it. And it was the fact that they thought they could see. This is what we see. This is what God looks like, acts like, feels like, bees like. We see this. This has happened outside of our seeing. Therefore, we're saying it cannot be God. And because of that, Jesus is saying, you guys are blind to God because you've refused to travel outside your own definition, your own boundaries, to see that God has moved outside of them and has done something beautiful and miraculous. And if you would honest, if you would say, and Jesus goes on to say, if you were to acknowledge that you were blind, you would see. In other words, Jesus was saying, you've defined, but you need to undefine. You need to remove your definition and allow the edges of your understanding. Don't let them define who God is, but allow those edges to be challenged and to be stretched and to be moved beyond the position that they are in. When you say that you see, you'll only accept what's within the boundaries of that seeing, and anything beyond that will be blocked out. Now, Paul talked about God as being the God who is above and beyond all that we could ever ask or think or imagine. And this is incredibly powerful too, because if God is beyond all we can ask, all we can think, and all that we can imagine, then we must accept the fact that there's a lot of stuff that I could imagine about what God might be able to do. And yet, God can go beyond that. Because God can, the spirit moves where the spirit wants to move. The goose runs where the goose wants to run. The borders of our tent, to use Isaiah's phrasing, needs to be able to be enlarged if and when that is necessary. So when we box God, we are closing off access to the possibility of things that are outside of the definition that we've given to God, the name that we've given to God, the boundary that we've placed around God, the box that we've put God in. And the problem is when we become so comfortable within those boundaries and we never brace ourselves, prepare ourselves for the possibility that there could be something outside of that, when the Spirit does move outside of that, we suddenly find ourselves in the horrible, horrible situation of being too scared or unprepared to follow. These Pharisees couldn't bring themselves to see the beautiful thing that had happened for this man because they couldn't bring themselves to imagine that God would go outside the boundaries that they had set up for God. But what's really sad about that And if you think about the boundaries you may have placed on someone or something before, and then they go outside of that, and you do allow yourself to see it, or even God, that you put some certain boundaries around God, and then you drop those boundaries and you allowed yourself to see it, and you start to see truth and beauty and goodness that are beyond the definitions that you had, where you didn't think that there could be truth or beauty or goodness, because out there must be bad, because it's not God according to the boundaries that you had defined and set up. But instead, we follow God across the threshold of those boundaries, and suddenly we find out that our boundaries were way too small. Our definition was way too restrictive. And as someone, I think most of you know and understand my background, that I literally, at the age of, what would have been 13 or 14, started taking myself along to an evangelical church. Even though I was testing the waters with a whole bunch of other things, this was where I was fellowshipping. This is where I was learning about the Bible. You know, when I was 16, I actually began a bubble course, which I later graduated from. It was a part-time one, but I started when I was 16 years old under the tutorage of my then pastor. And I'm very grateful for that, because this pastor gave me such a good grounding in the Bible that if you were to say, oh, where is this in the Bible? I'd probably be able to tell you. I know my way around that book pretty well. But here's the problem. Because I knew my way around that book pretty well, my understanding, the things that I had been taught by this particular train of understanding of Christianity, which was relatively, well, small when I compare it to what it is now, but it was, and I put this in inverted commas, but it was right? And I could understand God, and I could explain God to you, and that's what was important, right? And so here I have this understanding of God, an understanding of the Bible, and the understanding of what church is supposed to be and how worship's supposed to happen, and anything outside of that is wrong, bad, naughty, and so on. And then God comes along and starts to do things outside your definition. And at first, it's dead right scary, isn't it? And I work with so many people and walk with so many people who are going through this deconstruction, reconstruction phase. It's probably one of the reasons why I started The Table. And it's probably one of the reasons why there are so many people that I, you know, walk with now. And some of them now coming along to do that with me more formally, to walk with them and to sit with them and to encourage them and to help them through this really scary moment of going, hang on, the spirit, the goose, has run outside the boundaries of my tent, and I either have to wander outside and see where it's gone, or I have to sit in there and say that there is nothing out there that's worth looking at. And as scary as it is, we're encouraged by Scripture to enlarge the borders of our tent, to reach out, to stretch out, to follow the wind where this wind blows, to follow the goose where the goose goes, and to see what God is up to see what amazing, beautiful goodness and truth that God is doing outside of our definition, that we can then, we're invited to expand ourselves and to embrace that as well. We can't let what's happening outside the scope of our knowledge, our understanding, our box, or our definition go off, because it's not worth it. It's honestly not worth it. If God is who God is, if the thing that we see go off out there really isn't of God, then I think God's big enough to look out for us. And if it's not of God, well, that's okay. Come back to the edges of where you were. But if it is of God, are you prepared to undefine the way that you've defined God, so that you can include this new thing that you've learned, this new discovery, this new possibility, this new beauty, this new truth, this new goodness? Are you prepared to expand and enlarge, so to undefine, but don't fall into the danger of redefining? This is not about redefine. I've called this undefined for a purpose, because the second that you redefine, you've set the boundaries back up again. And so I encourage you, friend, not to make the same mistake, that when you undefine, leave it undefined. One of the scariest things I've ever heard is that space is still expanding. And I have so many questions about that. Space is expanding, so it has no edge. Because what is it expanding into? And surely there's no defined edge that you can see that follows that as you go through. right? But this is kind of like that. It's a scary thought to think that this edgeless thing is continuing to grow into this thing that, is it there or is it not there? I don't know. They don't know. But it's expanding. And I think what we need to do is to be careful not to try and put edges up on that expansion, because it still defines it. What we need to do is let the edges remain fuzzy, let them remain unclear, uncertain. This is why the mystics would say, retain the mystery, hold on to the mystery of things. Because, friend, when you're prepared to step outside of the boundary, when you're prepared to let go of the edges, when you're prepared to open the box, when you are prepared to undefine, then the limitless God becomes completely limitless again. And I'm not going to talk about this next bit too much, but I just want to drop this little gem in for you to think about. God isn't the only thing we do this to. We do this to other people. We do this to other circumstances. We do this to other cultures and countries and other things like that. We set up our definitions on this is what caricaturism is. This is what, you know, you get a caricature of someone. This is what generalizations are. We do this to other people groups. We do this to other human beings. But we also do it to ourselves. And while I'd encourage you to expand, or not just undefine who God is in your mind, so that God can continue to blow your mind away with who God is, I'm telling you now, 30 years into this journey, or just over 30 years into this journey with God for me, and God continues to blow my mind away every day with what God is and what God's about and what God is doing in the world and in people and in each other. And the God that I had set myself up to believe in so long ago, I look at that understanding and definition of God now and I go, oh my goodness, what a horrid, nasty, evil God I had set up. And thank goodness I was a God, you know, gave me the courage, or I found the courage to undefine and allow it to expand. But where have you done this to others, and where have you done this to yourself? Put boundaries around who you are and what you're about. And perhaps there are other things outside of God, apart from God, that you also need to think about undefining as well. And if you want help and encouragement with that, or need some help and encouragement with that, let me know. I want to be here for you to help you do that, because my friend, and I'm getting a little bit teared up saying this, but my friend, there is so much joy, beauty in letting go of those defined edges and stepping out of them and going, you know what, I'm not going to put those tight, boxed in edge things in, definitions again. It is time to undefine, to allow those edges to be fuzzy, to let mystery continue to inspire us with awe and wonder, and to not allow the edges we've set up stop God or ourselves or anybody else from truly being that which they truly are meant to be. And so, my friend, may you find the courage to undefine, even if it's just a little bit, even if it's just pulling a bit of sticky tape off that box that you've put those things in. May you be prepared to expand and to discover the beauty and the joy and the wonder that's beyond the edges that you've set up. May you have the courage to let go of some things that you've placed inside that box or edge or definition that truly don't belong there. And may you be given the courage to embrace the things that should be a part of how you understand this ever-growing and expanding and wonderful beauty that is our world, that is others, that is God, and that is ourselves. My friend, undefine and grow, and may grace, peace, love, and hope go with you as you do this day and every day. Amen. Thanks so much for listening to episode 7 of Monk on the Mic, the Monk in Docs podcast, Undefine. And from Saxon, who's still sleeping, and from Stanley, who's eating his foot, and from me, Mark Gladman, the Monk in Docs, I love you, my friends. Have a wonderful day. Peace be with you.